Hello and welcome to this bonus video. Now to create this bonus, we developed a new question and put it to several of our experts. And that question is, what holds people back from being all that they can be? And what keeps our clients from dreaming bigger dreams for themselves? You're about to hear answers to this question from seven expert practitioners. They'll share their insights, they'll share case studies, and a couple of exercises that you can use in your work with your clients. I think you'll find it useful, so let's get started.
Partly it's conditioning what they've been taught to dream and believe is possible in their earlier times. Partly it might have to do with their own self-worth. Partly it might have to do with the social kind of conditioning and so forth. And one of my favorite practices that I do, because I work both with meditations of compassion and mindfulness with people, I also do a kind of visualization, guided meditations, in which when they feel themselves in a limited circumstance, I'll have them close their eyes, sense themselves in that very limited circumstance, and then imagine a wisdom figure. It could be Buddha or Mother Mary or Jesus or Gandhi or Kuan Yin or the goddess of compassion or Solomon, doesn't matter. Whoever wants to come to them, some wisdom figure, taking over their body and showing them how they would handle it. And it's an amazing thing because within 30 seconds, for almost everybody, some luminous, wise being will appear and say, oh yeah, my body's much more relaxed than yours, and I know how to handle this difficult thing in court or that terrible thing in the family where people are fighting over money. You go in calm, you listen in this way, and there is a kind of inner intelligence that starts to shine when they allow that wise part, my teacher called it the one who knows, the wisdom part, to speak to them, or the compassionate part, and then they get different symbolic gifts and advice and so forth from the wisdom figure. And when they're done, I'll say, all right, how long did that take? This is 5 minutes. How long did it take for, you know, Solomon or Mother Mary to appear and give you guidance? And it was like 30 seconds. I said, well, where do they live? You know, here. What kind of advice? How did they do it? You already know what you need. And they begin to realize that the limiting beliefs and the kind of inner sense of the small self, the body of fear, is not the end of the story, is not who they are.
As we grow up, you know, our attachment figures see us in a certain way. And in that seeing, they're going to welcome and accept and confirm certain aspects of us, right? And they're going to disconfirm or deny other aspects. So Philip Bromberg writes about this so eloquently, that our core self is really made up of what our primary attachment figures both confirmed and disconfirmed. And those disconfirmed parts, He talks about them as not me self states. We could also say that, you know, it's a part of the implicit self, because a child has to push those parts away in order to be accepted in that environment. So if we look at Steve Porges' polyvagal theory, a child will do whatever he or she can to stay safe, and if that means meeting parents' expectations and pushing a part of you away, then that's what we all do. So those not me self states really contribute to holding us back from being all that we can. You know? So if a parent doesn't confirm our exuberance, we're going to hold our exuberance back. That becomes not me. If they don't confirm our anger, the angry feelings become not me. If they don't confirm our sadness or our grief, that becomes not me. And we try to push it away, and it doesn't become a part of our fullness. Yeah.
So how do you work with people to help them get back into the not me?
Well, I look at how the body holds that part away, right? Like what's going on in the body that reflects both what the parents confirmed and what they denied. And we can get really subtle with the patterns, you know, like with one woman, she felt like the vulnerability, well, what we discovered was that the vulnerability of her heart was not welcomed in her family. And there was just a slight pulling in of her left shoulder, like a protection around the heart. But it was very slight. It wouldn't be visible, to somebody who wasn't a trained body reader. But then it can also be much more profound, where, I can give an example of a Vietnam veteran who he had a lot of trauma, and we resolved his trauma and all his dysregulation. But then later in the therapy, what he became aware of was that he had never felt like a man. And as we explored it through his posture, there was this kind of sagging in his posture. He wasn't taking up a lot of space. He wasn't sitting upright. He wasn't broadening his shoulders. And he was a big guy, but he was keeping himself small. And he began to remember how his mother especially had kind of belittled him whenever he was big, whenever he was all he could be. He gave the example of going to Catholic school, and when he graduated from Catholic school, he said he was so happy and so excited. And his mother said, well, you just remember all the money we spent to send you through school. And he said he felt himself immediately, you know, start to keep himself small again. So in his therapy, he had to learn to take up space and to be as big as he was and as tall and as full, just as full as he was. And we know now with Amy Cuddy's research that if a person is not in a what she calls a power pose, is not upright and taking up all that space, that the cortisol starts to go up and the testosterone goes down. And just the opposite happens when someone's sitting tall and taking up their space, being as full as they are. I think of it as living in every bit of your body, like just filling every bit of your body up with energy and, you know, life and all, so that all of you can really be present.
I think sometimes people are trained to think in a more rigid fashion, that that's the right way to do things. I think I have a lot of dear friends who would qualify as just, you know, or maybe it's the way the brain works. But I think sometimes people just tend to think in more structured ways, outline form, that don't make it easy to go beyond that. And these are often very focused people who can really focus and get the job done, but sometimes they can get stuck in the job and forget the bigger picture. So that's one thing. Another thing is some people think it's arrogant. Who am I to dream big? That's obnoxious. I think that tends to be the culture of your upbringing. If somebody basically said to you, who do you think you are? Are you getting the big head? You know, so I think that holds people back. And then again, I think there is this idea that you can threaten people. You can turn people away. Your spouse will leave you if you dream your dream. It will make him feel crowded out of your life or threatened. So I think that's a possibility too.
So how do we work with people who are in any of these ways held back from dreaming bigger dreams?
I often liked to use people's imaginations to just imagine, okay, so what if? And, you know, the conditional tense is the best thing that ever happened to psychotherapy. When you say to somebody, what if you were to, you know, what if you were to do this? And what would that look like if it were to look like anything at all? And maybe it wouldn't. But if it does, what would that look like? I think you can sort of guide people to dream out loud with a lot of permission and structure. So that's one thing. And another is, you know, the business of, okay, so what's the worst thing that could happen? What would be the downside of this? You'd fail? Okay, what would that look like? What would be so terrible about failing? And then, of course, spitting in the soup. And isn't failing not trying anyway? Isn't that the failure to not try? No. So, you know, using their own words of self-criticism to criticize the self-criticism.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk for a second about how working with people around their comfort zones. So there are times when dreaming bigger dreams isn't comfortable. How do you work with someone to deal with the uncomfortability that goes along with dreaming bigger dreams?
I had a friend who used to say to his patients, we did group therapy together, so I used to watch him operate. And he had some great lines. By the way, well, I'll answer your question first. So he used to say to people, it's only anxiety. It doesn't mean anything. And I just love that line. And people usually say, what do you mean it doesn't mean anything? It feels terrible. But it was very effective the way he would put that out there. It's just anxiety. It doesn't mean anything. And people would have to stop and think. And that challenged things right there. Does that make any sense? Yeah. I love that line. I use it on myself sometimes. And, you know, just anxiety won't kill you.
I think we give too much weight sometimes to anxiety.
Feeling, yes. Yeah, we do. We do. It's just, and the other thing, of course, is it's just energy. It has a very similar physiological sensation as exhilaration. It's not that different. It's the interpretation that messes us up, you know. His other great line, by the way, which relates to maybe other questions.
Uh-huh.
But his other great line that he would ask people in group therapy was, so what's it to you? And that meant everything. What's it to you? It was a wonderful way to ask people to go deeper into what made them work. But it was said like a street guy. So mm-hmm. What's it to you? Very effective. Anyway, I loved that too.
There are parts of us that do have big dreams, and then there are parts of us that are terrified to try and manifest those dreams. And so often there's a kind of war inside. And depending on our past experiences, the parts of us that are terrified of dreaming big, not only dreaming big, but even starting to act on those dreams, will win. And so at least most of the clients that I see, that's the case. People don't come in saying, I'm living my dream. They come in saying, I've got this dream, but I can't seem to find the courage to pursue it. So as we suss out what's holding them back, it's usually beliefs and emotions that are carried by these parts of us that are stuck in scenes of the past that just don't let us take those kinds of risks again.
So how do we help people connect to their potential?
So again, we need to heal. It's very hard to override some of those parts. So there are systems, some forms of coaching that are really just trying to rev you up and get you out there and really override all these fears. not a big fan of that, because you wind up exiling even further the parts of you that aren't totally behind the project. So my inclination is to maybe first have the client share the dream, share the vision, and then notice what comes up inside of them as they start to think about that. And then we start to go to the parts of them that are so afraid to let them do this. Not to convince them that it's going to be okay, but instead to get to know those parts from a respectful place and learn about the fears they have and help them, give them permission to show where they're stuck in the past, where they got these fears. And then there's a process by which we can actually get them out of where they're stuck and unload those fears. And then the way is clear for the people to follow their dreams.
Could you tell us a story about working with someone where you help them deal with this issue of not being all they can be or dreaming bigger dreams?
So I was just in France working with a group of people who are social change agents, and they all have big dreams about changing the world, and each of them is involved in one way or another. Some are in the peace movement, some are involved in corporations, some in education, and so on. And so one guy is responsible for training about 400 medical students and residents in France, in this big medical center in Paris. And his dream was to incorporate a lot more psychological kinds of sophistication in medical students and help them become much more sensitive to the needs of patients and also to how much trauma is behind a lot of their medical issues. And so, and he'd done a lot of research, and he put forth this big curriculum that he wanted to install, and was terrified of facing the administration of the hospital, who were very skeptical of any of this kind of thing. And so, you know, he had this big dream, but he was really afraid of being shamed by trying to follow it by these white coat people. And so I had him focus on the fear and find it in his body, and he found it in his gut, and had him listen to it about what it's afraid would happen. And it took him back into his past, the authoritarian father, and a father who, whenever he would start to try to do things, would feel competitive with him and would have to chop him down. And so I had him witness all of that and get that younger part of him out of where it was stuck. And this, I just did this a few weeks ago, so I don't know the outcome exactly. But as he came back and he didn't carry that fear that was stuck back there anymore, the path seemed a lot clearer to him about being able to go to this board and present his ideas. And, you know, before he probably would have done it, but he would have done it both kind of combination of shaking in his boots, but also from a place that would take over when he was scared, that would make him come across almost as arrogant, as a compensation. So this time, as he imagined doing it, he was doing it more from this place I call self, leadership, which was calm and confident and clear, those kinds of C words.
Again, I'm going back to fear, doing something that feels risky or scary. But you know what? We can have fear come up. The signal anxiety comes up anytime we're even going to do something new or different. It doesn't have to be dangerous or scary. It's just new or different. So when we experience that signal anxiety, uh-oh, I've never seen this before, I'm not sure I should be doing this, we can stop and the shame, which smallifies us, and we tend to live in a smaller box than we need to because we're afraid to risk the failure or you know, make a fool of ourselves before we finally get it right. So those are the two things, I think, that hold us back most from being all we can be.
And Linda, just in case there are practitioners like physicians and nurses and social workers who aren't familiar with the term signal anxiety, would you give me like a really brief?
Mm-hmm. So when we're about to do something new, unfamiliar, the dopamine levels in our brain stop. Uh-oh, I'm not used to seeing this. And what we experience in our brain is anxiety. It's just a signal that comes up from the body. And we can interpret that as, oh, we shouldn't be doing this. The best thing to do often in those cases is to go ahead and act, go ahead and do the scary thing, the unknown, the unfamiliar thing. That restores the dopamine levels in the brain. So we're being proactive, taking action. In fact, that's a technique that I teach a lot, to do one scary thing a day. That's a phrase that came from Eleanor Roosevelt. And when we do one scary thing a day, a conscious choice to meet that feeling, uh-oh, this is unknown, this is unfamiliar, don't know if I should be doing it, so I'm going to do it, that's my practice. And we begin to get the sense that, oh, I could do that. That wasn't so hard. Oh, now I'm getting good at meeting this signal anxiety and taking action. So we're actually reconditioning the brain's interpretation of that signal anxiety and saying it's a cue to action and that's what I'm going to do.
So how do we help connect people to their potential?
So I think one of the key findings of the modern behavioral science research as well as the neuroscience research is to help people shift from a performance-based mindset to a possibility-based mindset. And because when we're in a performance-based mindset, that sets us up for performing, possibility of failure, possibility of shame coming from the failure, and we can often stop before we start. But when there's a possibility mindset, it's okay to experiment. It's okay to make a mistake. It's okay to try again after you've made a mistake. And we're finding that when there's that possibility mindset, it's a lot easier to try something, make the mistake, go ahead and learn from it, forgive yourself for making the mistake, and trying again. So when people can shift from a performance mindset to a possibility mindset, the research is showing they're actually twice as likely to meet their goals. That mindset simply opens up the perseverance and the experimentation and the trying again that makes achieving potential, achieving a goal possible. And then, so again, I would reiterate the importance of self-compassion in that model, because when there's permission to make a mistake, it doesn't mean you're a bad person, it doesn't mean you're unworthy, it doesn't mean people won't like you, it's just okay. When we have the compassion, the self-acceptance, the self-appreciation for trying, then that really antidotes the negative voices that come up in that performance model and keeps us kind of free of them, and we're more able to try new things and move forward.
So what techniques have you found that help people get out of their comfort zone and reach for their full potential?
So having been a therapist now for 25 years and a coach for almost 10, it's essential first that people even have a comfort zone. People have to be able to stabilize out of trauma, out of stress, out of crisis, and come into a comfort zone. So that trajectory has to include recovering their resources, recovering their resilience, recovering a sense of capacity that they are someone who is able to make choices. And then from there, bringing in positivity, and that is never to negate or deny the negative, not ever. The negative is always going to be there, and we're always going to respond to it. But to bring in the power of positive emotions or positive behaviors, and again, the long list of kindness, gratitude, compassion, serenity, joy, awe, delight, love, all of these positive qualities, behaviors, attitudes, that shift the functioning of the brain. That's what's key. Those positive emotions shift the functioning of our brain toward more openness, more approach to life, more engagement with learning, and they create more optimism, more possibility, more creativity, more resilience. Resilience is actually a direct outcome of practicing those positive emotions. So when I'm working with clients and I can hear the litany of fear, shame, gripe, complaint, resentment, whatever, I will ask for just one moment. Is there one moment that's different? Is there one moment that's positive? Is there one moment that's new? Doesn't have to be enough to antedate the whole shebang, but just one to get people thinking differently, trying on a new possibility, getting them to shift their brain in that way. So very often I have two clients in particular that can be very negative for lots of reasons. Life has been a struggle. So we've learned before we begin the therapy session to do a 3-minute gratitude free write. We both do it. We're just writing down stream of consciousness things that we're grateful for. I don't even ask them to share the list, but the process opens up their brain to the possibility of change in the therapeutic hour. So it becomes a major intervention to help people move into a comfort zone and then beyond the comfort zone to the possibilities beyond that.
So when you're doing this 3-minute exercise, tell me the directions you gave them the first time.
In the context of why they're in therapy, how they hope to grow or change, even if that's hard, even if there's a lot of negativity wrapped around that. And I might give a little mini lecture about the benefits of positive emotion practice to behavior, but also to the brain. And then just say, would they be willing to try? If it doesn't work, we don't have to keep doing it. But would they be willing to try? And I'll do it with them. And when I ask them to write down things that they're grateful for, I will sometimes give a little instruction to write down people that they're grateful for, because that's always where we start, people that we're grateful for, and then the processes that they're grateful for, that they can walk, that they can swallow food and eat, that they can think, that they can, you know, move their body, just the processes of being alive. Then I'll ask them for the web of life. People that keep their life going, even though they may never meet them. The person who delivers the mail and picks up the garbage and fixes the highways and tests the water quality and staffs the emergency room and all the people who keep our lives going, even though we may never meet them. And when they start writing down about that web of life, then they can open up their perspective beyond their own personal dramas and traumas to, yes, I am held by the universe. So I'll usually say that much, and we get started. And after a while, they'll remind me that we're doing a gratitude practice first.
What do I think holds people back from being all they can be? If I had to pick one single thing, it would be finitude. It would be failing to come to full grips with the finite nature of life, that you can't be everywhere. You can't do everything, and you're not going to live forever. And there's a kind of a grasping that can happen that the mind wants to do inside that can be very frightening. Like, I have to achieve this or that. I mean, let me say it this way so you can see the connection. Suppose I could guarantee you that you could live forever, and no matter how many times you try and fail, you'll have another chance to do it. My guess is failure doesn't end up being as much of an issue, would it?
Hmm.
It'd be more like practice. I think what happens here in holding people back is the fear that they're going to get it wrong, they're going to do it wrong, they only have so much time. And if you dig down underneath that, it's the failure to inhale finitude, to inhale death and carry it with you, to inhale the fact that you're not everywhere, you're not God, you can't do everything. So with clients, I usually start small. I don't start big, because as soon as you get big, you know, and I start with finitude and meaningless of walking inside what they fear would happen in failure, what they fear would happen in a lack of contribution or achievement. And what they fear is meaninglessness. Well, as far as I know, the physicists say either there's enough dark matter and it'll collapse back into an infinitely dense pea eventually to explode and happen again. Or there isn't enough and it'll expand forever and grow dark. Those are the two ends of the universe. Which one sounds really meaningful? Neither one. So outside of our faith traditions, I don't know of of anyone guaranteeing you applause into infinity. So what are you going to do while you're here? How are you going to spend your life moments? And if you're playing small, well, at least play small. And then once you get the sense of play, what the hell, you might as well play big.
Oh, many, many internalized stories, mental models about what I'm allowed to want as a man, as a woman, as a gay person, as a trans person, as a child. You know, what society? I really think that we have to bring society into this, what I'm allowed to want, what my culture and my religion have told me. You don't need any more. You have enough. Why do you want more all the time? You know, a Priya is perfectly fine. Why do you need a bigger car? You're never happy. You always want more. You're greedy. You're selfish. There's a lot of words that go with curb yourself, curb your enthusiasm, you know, keep it small. There is the fear that there is the fear of consequences. And then there is the fear of I'm not going to be good enough to actually manifest my dreams. So it's often either on the continuum of am I good enough, or on the continuum of the bigger I am, what will it do to the people around me? And will I be punished for it?
So let's talk a little bit about each of them separately. Let's start with am I good enough question. How do you work with someone who's maybe struggling with that? And
you know, I have various ways to enter it, but I will say that one of the ways I enter these days is that in traditional life, we didn't necessarily have that question because we knew we were good when we did what we were expected to do. We had roles. If I was the eldest son, I knew what I had to do. If I was a wife, I knew what I had to do. If I was the father of the house, I knew what I had to do. And therefore, I was good enough if I obliged by the expectations and the roles that were imposed on me. Modern times has created the extraordinary invention of psychological misery and of constant, chronic self-evaluation. So when a person says that, I say, now I know that you are a person of our time. Because your grandmother, she wouldn't have understood that question, or at least your great-grandmother. This is an amazing question we're left with, where we are constantly, since now we are products and commodified products on this market, ourselves, wondering, am I good enough? Am I lovable? Am I pretty enough? Am I desirable? Are you desiring me? Am I going to last long enough? Am I going to be interesting enough to go past two dates? You know, and what about a year? So God forbid, a lifetime. How is that ever possible? And I begin by trying to kind of reflect philosophically almost, jokingly, a little bit together about, isn't this such a weird question? How did we get to that kind of question? You know, it's the one of the greatest revolution in science was Pasteur, right? It was the idea that if you actually inject the very thing in and of itself, you create a vaccine. So I always think of that metaphor. Sometimes I talk about these belief systems as being external to us. I think about our late Michael White, and I think about externalizing the problem. This is not your personal problem. You are actually a good citizen of the modern time. And now we have a conversation about that. And my God, I've had that question many times myself. It's not because I'm your therapist that I haven't asked myself that question. And then, you know, well, the weirdest thing is that we actually, you know, I'm part of the industry. That is, you know, we're there's a you're meant to feel bad. I'm meant to make you feel better, and our society is meant to make you buy certain things with which you certainly will make you feel better. And this is a very interesting system we are all prisoners of. So that's one way to go. Depends on the kind of person. It depends on the age of the person. It depends on the options of a person. Sometimes it's really to say to a person, you're really hard with yourself. You don't realize how much you have actually done and how important you have been and how instrumental you have been. Is it because you don't know? Is it because people haven't told you? Or is it because you don't hear it when they tell you because you are always demanding of yourself and always so critical and there's always better? Tell me, what fuels this? Am I good enough? So that's another way of entering on that one. There's others, but those would be just two entry doors.
In the other way, where we were saying some people believe the idea that they aren't supposed to ask or aren't supposed to want, that they would take too much if they dreamed bigger dreams.
We never talk about smaller dreams. It's an interesting thing. By definition, when we think dreams, we think big. So I think that some of us come out of our histories or out of our personal histories, political histories, squelched, and made to take the least amount of space possible, small. And it takes strength, confidence, a lot of support, a lot of people who believe in you before you believe in yourself to actually allow yourself to go big. But then I see artists who were not necessarily meant to be small and squelched, and they too need somebody else who can see their potential when they don't yet see it. And I think that we always live with our internal image and then the image that other people reflect on us. And it is that interplay that actually allows us to tap into the dreams. And a community of people who all say, go for it. Why not? It's a good thing. So it's an individual response, and it's also a collective response. If you live in a community where everybody says, you know, less is fine. And anybody who wants something for themselves stands out and is boastful and is selfish, then you curb your dreams. But if you are surrounded by people who all say, you know, why, you know, go big, you get the permission to go big. If you constantly hold yourself small, it's really about figuring out all the blocks. The blocks from what you were told, the blocks to how you view yourself, inner criticism, lots of negative inner talk. Actually, not that different from the inner talk that we just talked about a minute before of, you know, I don't deserve it, I shouldn't do it. Basically, ultimately, they are all conversations of self-worth. But self-worth is not a universal. The concept of self-worth, of social competence, all these ideas are very culturally embedded. They are different in different cultures, and they are certainly different in the modern culture versus traditional culture. I don't think these words are just universal, absolutist concepts. My Senegalese people talk about self-worth very different than my North American clients.
How about your European people versus North American?
It's a mix between, you know, the responsibility to the others and the permission to give to oneself. I think that could, and Europe is a continent, so it's not one answer, but it is really a continuum between how much one can put the I in the center and how much one puts the needs of others in the center of the I.
I think probably the greatest gift that we give our clients in terms of helping them achieve their potential is for us to know rock solid 100% that potential is there and that we can see underneath the defenses, underneath the symptoms, underneath the crises and conditions to their own goodness, their own capacities, their own energy, And when we see that, they may not believe it at first, but I learned this one from Dan Hughes, who often works with children who've been traumatized or abused, and he'll listen to their story of themselves. And he'll say, I understand, that's how you see yourself. I see you slightly differently. Would you be interested to hear how I see you? And then offering a different view, a different experience. They may reject it, they may minimize it at first, but it's on the table and it's in the energy between us in the room, that another possibility exists and that we can move toward that. So us seeing and believing in the potential of the client is a priori. That has to be there from the beginning.
Linda, have you ever had someone that you didn't like?
Here's actually how I work with myself about that. There are certainly behaviors and traits that I don't like. So I work with myself, but what do I love? And I come to what can I love about this client? Because that becomes more important than my reaction, liking or disliking particular traits or behaviors. And I have to rest in that place of love and unconditional positive regard for the client. That's where I do the therapy from.